on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Advertising is based on one thing. Happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay.
Terry O'Reilly is probably the most famous ad guy in Canada, which is weird because the truth is that Terry O'Reilly hasn't actually been working in advertising for years. The guy sold his ad business in 2018. And, you know, since then, he's had the same job that I have. He's a podcast host, and he's the publisher of a podcast network called Apostrophe. They publish a whole bunch of shows, but most prominently is Terry's show, Under the Influence. That is his hit show about marketing and advertising, currently in its 12th season. But he's been at it for a lot longer than that. Before Under the Influence, he hosted 5 seasons of a similar show called The Age of Persuasion. And before that, he had a show called O'Reilly on Advertising. He has been talking about advertising and marketing for a long time. Hundreds of episodes examining every possible angle on this industry. For example, an episode called Touch the Pickle, Marketing Gender Equality. Also, the commercial from the Black Lagoon, Horror in Advertising. It goes on and on. Terry O'Reilly is just endlessly fascinated with his industry, and Canadians seem to be fascinated with it too. I mean, he reaches 1 million radio listeners a week. He has served 50 million podcast downloads since 2012. There is this huge appetite out there for his insider's take on the ad business, even if he's not really an insider anymore on the ad business. But I don't know, maybe it's not fair to say that Terry O'Reilly left advertising, because there's one product that Terry O'Reilly is still advertising the hell out of, and that product is Terry O'Reilly. His radio show on the CBC works as a permanent national ad campaign for his podcast business. Somehow this guy convinced the CBC to pay him to advertise his own podcast. And of course, he sells ads on his podcast, and his podcast is itself a commercial for his books. And of course, he does paid speeches where he sells those books. If any of this sounds like shade, I promise you that is not where I'm coming from here. I mean, I want to know how he did it. Game recognizes game. O'Reilly's not pretending to be doing anything else. He has no pretense about what he does. He is unabashedly involved in private enterprise, and somehow he has convinced the public broadcaster to fuel it. I have always wanted to get the story of how that came to be. I also happen to like his show. I always find it to be well-made and interesting, even when its ethically agnostic attitude towards consumer culture can sometimes infuriate me. And I'm going to get to ask him about that because Terry O'Reilly joins me in a minute in our studio. Wait for it. I want to get into a fight with you about which one of us was the first to start a podcast company in Canada. I think maybe you'll win. Was it me?
Yeah.
I don't know because you had a company called Pirate that made your first show.
Yes, but Pirate was a commercial entity. In other words, our biggest clients were advertising agencies. So what Pirate did was we created radio campaigns from the ground up, and we directed the voiceover, sound, and music for television commercials. It was all advertising.
Mm-hmm.
So when, in 2005, when we pitched the show to CBC, I had studios. Audio was my skill set, so I just thought, I'm going to do it at our studios. So for the first, probably till about 2011 maybe, or 2012, I did it at Pirate. And then I built my own studio and did it from there.
You built Apostrophe, and you built Apostrophe as a podcast studio.
I started podcasting Under the Influence in 2011. I wanted to podcast earlier than that. I was ready to go probably 3 years earlier than that. But I kept waiting for CBC to clear music rights.
I figured out the first time we spoke. I misremembered it as when I was setting up Canada Land, but that's not the case. It was, after my first series with CBC, I had sold them on the idea for a second series, but I didn't really trust them. And I was wondering, like, do I have to go back to work there to make a CBC radio show? Is there another way to do it?
Right.
And I thought, well, Terry O'Reilly has a CBC radio show, but doesn't work at the CBC.
Right, right.
And you were nice enough to speak with me and let me know that you had this pirate radio company and that you had your own team of people and you independently produced this thing and then you sold it to the CBC. And that sounded terribly complicated to me at the time, so I went back to work for the CBC.
You know, that part of my story is so funny because when myself and Mike Tennant, who's another radio guy, when we pitched my radio show idea to CBC, not thinking CBC would ever buy it because why would the advertising-free CBC take a show on advertising?
Yeah.
They took it, which was shocking to us. And then we had to figure out how to mount a national radio show. But in the negotiations, we negotiated to own the show and license it to CBC. Not that we were such savvy negotiators, Jesse, because I thought that's the way it's done. It was just naivete. But now I own my show, which is fantastic. But it was not a grand plan.
I mean, it's an incredible thing, whether it happened by luck or by strategy. And I remember one of my bosses at CBC talking to me once and saying, they'll never do that again. Not with reference to you, but we were talking about Stuart McLean.
Right.
And I said, what? And she said, this guy negotiated ownership of his show and the intellectual property thereof. And he went to them and said, I want to have the rights to do live shows and put out CDs. And they thought, well, no one's ever done that. Like, you can have those rights. They're worthless to us because they weren't exploiting those rights.
Right.
And what ended up was he built, and here the pun is intended, a cottage industry.
And he was an industry.
Yeah. You make a podcast about marketing. Let's talk about podcasts as marketing because, I mean, at that time it was a radio show. But I can't believe that the CBC was paying him to make a show that they broadcast across the country, and then he goes from town to town doing big live shows, selling out, selling his books there.
CDs, everything. He took a busload of people across the country, and then he would swing through the northern states. He had an audience in the states, too.
If they had flipped it on him and said, from now on, you've got to pay us to keep the Vinyl Cafe, it probably would have made business sense.
Yeah, he might have done it. It's sort of like the Star Wars story, isn't it? When George Lucas, nobody wanted Star Wars. Everybody knows his story. But the interesting part of that story to me is he really wanted the licensing part of the deal. Like, he saw the future that he could do a lot of toys and things coming out of the show. And the studio just laughed their heads off and said, take it.
Yeah.
Thinking it was worthless.
And you have a similar thing going.
Yeah.
I would take that. Like, if CBC said, we're not going to pay you a dime, we couldn't do it with Candleland because we cover the CBC. But right. If we like Commons, let's say, we're going to air it on CBC Radio 1 to every community in the country. That would spike our podcast downloads. They could have it for free. I probably would even pay them something for that. So you got a sweet deal. You're like, your model is the Stuart McLean model. And I don't know, maybe there's a couple other people who sell content to CBC that way, but
I don't think there's many though.
That's a wonderful deal.
It is a wonderful deal. And as I said, just sheer serendipity luck of not knowing any better.
Because what do you know about marketing?
What do I know? Exactly right.
Getting back to the content and the culture clash of your work, which I think takes an explainer and an insider explainer and a curious right. approach to advertising and marketing. And I don't know, you're on what, 12th season of this series, and then there was the series?
All told, this is our 18th season since we started.
18 seasons of examining commercial culture.
Right.
On the CBC.
On the CBC.
I once did a documentary about marketing when I worked at the CBC, and I was told, like, there's not enough of the negative effects on culture and on society. If you're going to talk about marketing, you can't seem this positive about marketing. You know, I appreciate it. Like, we live in a very commercialized, marketing-heavy yeah. society, and I see value in having one place that considers itself a bit of a temple free from the pernicious mm-hmm. influence of advertising and marketing,
yep.
which is an interesting contrast to their podcast today, which are filled with ads, but we can leave that aside for a second. But there was a real moralizing, like, you can't even talk about this.
Which is why I was very surprised they took our show.
Yeah, me too.
I thought, going up the elevator that day, our pitch was basically this, Jesse. It was really simple. We basically said, most people hate advertising, and it's like architecture. It's everywhere in your life. But actually, when you dig down into it, advertising is a fascinating industry because it's the study of human nature. And nobody studies human nature like the advertising industry. And I said, Mike and I are not pundits and we're not journalists. We're actually working ad men in the trenches. We have access and we have stories. And we want to take people, we want to take average Canadians, not marketers, on a backstage cook's tour of what really happens in the boardrooms and the recording studios. That was the whole pitch.
Mm-hmm.
Going up the elevator that day, Mike and I looked at each other and I thought, they're going to say very interesting, not for us, but very interesting. Maybe we could do something else down the road.
Yeah.
That would have been a great meeting. But instead, Chris Boyce, who was in charge of radio at the time, he leaned back in his chair and said, we'll take it. And then we had to figure out how to do it. That was 18 years ago.
It's an interesting way of thinking about creativity and creative people because we're obsessed with artists and writers and people who look at communication as a way of like personal expression. And here it's, you've got people with very similar skill sets
right. In
a very purpose-oriented way. We're trying
solving
to solve
business problems.
Solving business problems with images and feelings and emotion. And I don't know, something about taking any kind of like moral judgment out of it allows you to, well, first understand what they're doing. I sometimes get left with like, I admire these people. Like, and I think a lot of people got into this. I mean, you started before Mad Men, but with Mad Men, people, it became kind of like fun to think about how these people work.
I think we got a big updraft from Mad Men, believe it or not. I think people got into the whole fun of Madison Avenue, and now that was era-specific. But I'll say this about that show. Matthew Weiner had somebody on that staff that had worked in the business.
Yeah.
That show, the dynamics of advertising, meaning the client relationships, the dynamics inside an agency, the pressures, the deadlines, the getting fired by, all of that was real.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a real uptick for people getting interested in the industry, which helped us.
Maybe this is a little bit of a digression, but I always wondered this when I'm listening to your show. You're talking about the creative minds who are coming up with the campaigns.
Yeah.
But you're doing that from Canada. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that a lot of the time, that creative work is done in the States. They come to Canada and then they just make a media buy.
Yes. There's still a lot of highly functioning Canadian advertising agencies putting out work. The toughest thing for me in my show is finding the stories about Canadian campaigns. The U.S. keeps everything. I can find the first radio ad done in 1923 with three clicks of a mouse. I can't find anything in Canada. There's no archive.
Oh.
It's really frustrating for me. I mean, because I spent my career in the business, I can call up ad people and say, tell me about that campaign you did. Or I can call up retired creative directors and say, remember that campaign you did in 1983? Tell me that story. But it's really frustrating for me because there's no archive in this country. In the States, there's the Duke archives at Duke University that are endless. And there's a ton of archives there. The U.S. has kept everything. They really bought into Marshall McLuhan's line that advertising is the cave art of any era. And here it's not the case. So it's an ongoing struggle for me to find Canadian stories, which I'm always looking for.
I've never thought about that once. That's so fascinating. And it's true. When you look back, you find like an old dusty magazine at somebody's, grandmother's house or in their cottage or something.
Right.
It's the ads that tell you so much.
Pirate donated a portion of our archives to McMaster University. We donated 50,000 commercials, which was only probably a third of our archive.
Of what you made?
Of what we made, yeah.
You made 50,000 commercials at Pirate?
We made way more than that. That was a third of our archive, was
wow.
50,000. But why McMaster was interested in it was because inside that archive was the first cellular phone advertising. There was Olympic advertising. There were federal election advertising. The first AIDS PSAs. Like, all of that was reflected in that archive because advertising is the great mirror of any era. Like you said, you look through a magazine, you can tell what clothes someone's wearing, exactly what decade that is.
Wow. But in Canada, we've lost our heritage.
Yeah. There's just no hunger, no desire to archive at all yet.
I listened to your show recently and you tried to sell me weed.
Yeah.
No judgment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I sell mattresses. I sell supplements. I once sold a monthly meat box subscription.
There you go.
How do you think about podcast advertising?
Well, we're trying to monetize our podcast the best we can because it keeps our company healthy and it allows me to pay people what they're worth. So it's important to us. And I'm in the advertising business, so I'm a big fan of advertising. The interesting question about cannabis and even gambling casinos is there are new categories, right? What we do is we take a look at everything that comes across our table and we decide whether it feels right to us. Cannabis, I don't have a problem with. It's legal. There's stores, there's retailers. I don't have a problem with it. Casino stuff is starting to come in. We'll have to see how that goes.
That kind of talks about the comfort question and the like, is this, you know, do I want to put my name on this?
Yeah.
What do you think about the industry that we're kind of, I'll say it, we're pioneering the podcast industry. We were in it a long time ago, and it's amazing to watch an industry go from nothing to a multi-billion dollar industry and to kind of try to navigate that. And it feels very new and fresh. At the same time, there are strains within it which feel like it's a return to like 1920s radio or something.
So true. When hosts are asked to read ads, it feels like it's the 1940 radio. And that's what everybody wants. Mm-hmm. They really don't want a slick presentation, and they're not really looking for conceptual ideas. Which is interesting to me because I came out of an entire career of trying to add a conceptual selling idea to an ad. Advertisers don't seem to want that. They're hoping for endorsements, which I don't really do. But what's also interesting about podcasting, I was reading this week, Jesse, I don't know if you saw it, podcasting is reaching 18 to 49, I think it is, age group, almost on par with AM, FM radio and linear TV this year. That's huge, right? That almost makes podcasting a mass medium.
That's incredible. And radio is something that doesn't get talked about as mass media, but in the early years of podcasting, it was always like, wow, we're 3% of radio? Like, radio has been so resilient. It's like a tank. Just this really...
It cannot be killed by conventional weapons.
That's right.
It really stays. Like, it's survived everything, right? It survived television and movies and the internet, and the numbers are still pretty good for radio.
You know, it's still very much mass media and millions and millions of people. Will we kill it?
I love the transition from radio to podcasting personally because I could tell stories. I had no time factor. Even our podcast version of our show is usually longer than our CBC version of the show because I don't have to be 27:30. So the storytelling gets better with podcasting for me.
My first media job was as a co-op student at Q107, and the most sort of beleaguered member of that staff was the copywriter for their ads, and it was so old school that you just have some hack kind of, I don't mean to put the guy down, but he just looked like such a sad sack. You know, those radio ads, like the quality of the experience of listening to FM radio, and then you get that block of ads. And it was interesting because these days you think about the tight brand controls that companies have. And here was this guy who was just like, you know, the radio ads like, hey, Jan, yes, Jim, let's head down to the Honda dealership. Like, and he just had to pump these things out. And I'd get pulled into the studio because they need like four people to like laugh or yell at a certain point or say one line. And the guy was just, he was a machine.
See, I started that way, Jesse. So my first job was at FM 108 Radio in Burlington, 1981. It was the only 50s and 60s radio station in Canada at the time because oldies were just becoming oldies, right? I was the sole copywriter and production guy for the entire radio station. So we had about 150 ongoing retail clients at any, and it's all local advertising, right? Some days I'd write 25 or 30 commercials a day. I would then need someone to voice them, so I'd stand outside the morning jock's door at 9 o'clock when he finished and drag him into the studio to record, and if we needed a second voice, I would do that second voice. And if I needed a third voice, I'd record that voice too, put my finger on the spindle, tape days, slow my voice down so it sounded like there were three of us in the room, like all of that. but I had to pump them out so fast, Jesse, that's why they don't sound so great, because the volume is crippling.
I think that's a big factor, but to the kind of complaint, the listener complaint of just how corny they can sound. There's a reason for that on FM radio. Like, to try to just grab people's attention in the first second. I was kind of given a crash course in this stuff. It's interesting to contrast that with the podcast ad format and the kind of fork in the road we're at right now. Because I'll admit something here. I like reading ads. I kind of feel connected to, like, George Burns. Like, what's Gracie getting up to next?
Right.
Well, first, a message from Lucky Strike. I love the flavor of my Lucky Strikes.
Right.
I understand that what a podcast is doing is taking a listener into a conversation. There's an intimacy, and you're saying, hey, sit down with me and this other person, and you get a seat on the couch while we have an interesting conversation. And to have some other message come in and be like, today, you know, Sunday, is to absolutely,
it's
severing that. And we kind of specialize. We're probably the only news podcaster where news personalities will read ad copy.
Right.
And that's a bit of a killer feature of, and we, our I'll advertise for our ads. We hear from our advertisers like, wow, your stuff converts two or three times as well as when we have our fanciest marketers put together a beautiful, polished, pre-recorded
with actors. Yeah. With trained actors.
Yeah. Because now they're dynamically inserting ads in podcasts. Yep. And we do a little bit of that for unsold inventory. And as a listener, like, it's a very different experience.
You mean the run of schedule stuff that is pre-produced, that gets dropped in. Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting notion. You know, it's in the advertising world, you try and not sound like the station you're on. Mm-hmm. In other words, you purposely try and leap out of the radio sounding so different from the environment you're in. When I talked to radio station owners and programming chiefs over there, they always told me, which is very interesting, we give preference to ads that sound like us.
Uh-huh.
So we were kind of working at odds. It took me deep into my career before I realized that they actually would give preferential positioning, meaning first ad out of the programming in a break, right? That's the best place to be, to ads that sounded most like their format. I spent my whole career trying not to do that.
You were fighting them.
I was fighting them.
Mm-hmm. I think that tells you something about the difference in the listening experience, that radio is ambient and becomes wallpaper, and an ad needs to somehow...
It has to.
...poke you in the ear and get your attention, whereas I think a good podcast... There are some podcasts that I think kind of play the ambient thing, like a three-hour rambling Joe Rogan thing.
Right.
Throw it on, forget about it. But if you're producing, and you specialize in highly produced, scripted, narrative radio, it's the kind of radio where you want people to, like, if they got home and there's still 5 minutes left...
Stay in the driveway.
That's it.
Yep.
So why break that spell when it's time to deliver?
I know. I even wrestle with the transition going from our show to our commercials, what that bridge should be, or should there be a bridge? Like, you know, I think we're both on Acast. Acast has a little mnemonic they use when they go to, and I wonder if that should even be in there. Like, I'm just constantly just thinking about that. Should we burst the bubble, as you say, or should we just transition right into the commercial so you don't take somebody by the collar and say, we'll be back in 5 minutes, you know?
We have different priorities because we, as a newsroom, want there to be, like, absolute clarity as to when you're listening to our editorial content and when you're listening to an ad.
Right.
And there are things that we'll do that the other guys won't do, and they'll consider it, like, the idea of, again, having a news personality read an ad is anathema. And I've had senior CBC colleagues tell me, like, I've been at this for 35 years, and I've never read a goddamn ad. Like, very
badge
proud.
Of honor. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless we have an objection to an advertiser, or unless there's a conflict of interest, I'm into it. You know, like, I'll give the personal endorsement. If there is a personal endorsement to be made.
Right. I have to be careful of that the way you have to be careful. You probably don't take on any media advertising, right? You wouldn't take on global.
That's right. On the Canada Land show, we cover them, and so we,
so you wouldn't
we
take that
can't
on.
Take that ad.
I have to be careful, too, with endorsements because I may be doing a story on that brand 2 months from
now. Right. You've got your lines in the sand.
Yeah, because if I say something great about that brand and I've endorsed it 2 months ago, it just, even though it's legitimate and there is no... funny business going on, it may not seem that way to them.
Well, you don't want the listener wondering if you're doing a half hour looking into Nestle's great campaign because they also bought a big block of ads on.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the same thing. Like I'm for sale when it comes to ads, but the listener absolutely can never wonder,
right,
is this an ad that I'm listening to?
Yeah.
And they can never wonder, is his coverage influenced by the ad? So that's where we kind of set those.
Yeah.
It feels quaint in a certain way, talking about these lines, because we live in a culture where
Google blurred that, don't you think? I mean, there was always church and state in my business. So, you would never put an ad, or the publisher of a magazine would never put an ad beside a story that had something to do with that advertiser. Like, they would put you further into the magazine. They would never. That was advertising from the 1920s to whenever Google showed up. And then Google makes a multi-billion dollar business of putting ads right beside content. Like, it's kind of interesting to me. Like, if you're searching something from Canadian Tire, right beside it might be stories about Canadian Tire on Google, right?
That's true. That's interesting. You know, and that's
that was their model.
It's also another way of thinking about conflict of interest, because newspapers were protecting conflict of interest from the advertiser's point of view. If we're taking Canadian Tire's money, it would not be fair to put their ad next to a story that was negative about them.
Right.
But we have to be able to report on them. So, you know, there was always a newsroom concern of like, you know, and sometimes they would miss it. And there's some funny instances where you'd have like an ad for a raincoat next to, I don't know, the raincoat factory is just burned down.
Right.
You know,
child labor. Yeah.
Yeah. Some say, yeah, there we go. You got it. And for the advertiser's sake, you would put that somewhere else.
Right.
But I never thought about that, that Google, there's no such, and it's all done algorithmically anyhow.
It is. And the next story down from Canadian Tire might be a story about how someone hates Canadian Tire. Like, they've really blurred that church and state thing completely, made a business model of it, and probably has one of the biggest businesses in the world as a result.
I wonder if it's a question of blurring it to the point where people don't notice, or if it's a question of, like, people are smart. They're smarter than they're often given credit for.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny to see the Nike ad next to a article that's exposing child labor in sweatshops, and you might take a screenshot of that, and there's an irony there.
Right.
But it doesn't have the same ironic quality if you search for Nike, and then there's like sponsored links at the top for Nike, and then there's some articles. It's just like, that's just what Google gave you.
Right.
And I think that people understand that.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about this in our coverage of this ongoing debate about how, you know, the big tech stole the ads. They stole the ads from the news. And I've never been able to feel terribly injured by having the ads stolen from the news, because, like, I kind of know that the news and ads was always a bit of a tortured relationship
right.
to begin with. It wasn't the greatest way to sell. Like, and advertisers never wanted to be next to real news. They never wanted to be next to war
right.
and conflict and people getting killed or, like, real social issues or politicians being scandalized. That was never a great place.
In network television, CBS, NBC, ABC, the news programs were the highest rated programs, therefore the most desirable for advertisers, right? But ironically,
yeah.
you don't want to be too near a war story, yet the most eyeballs are on that war story.
It's a good point, and that's this strange cognitive dissonance of having, you know, the world's going to hell, now go buy something. So this struggle to determine where lines should be and what's fair game, some of those arguments are like settled, and it's almost strange to tell my kids, like, yeah, actually, when they first started putting ads before movies, that was a big deal, and people were really upset.
You know why? I have a theory about that. There is a great unwritten contract in advertising, and that is, if you'll sit through this ad, Jesse, I will do something for you in return. So, you know, the ads in a magazine pay for the editorial. The ads in a newspaper pay for the reporters. The ads in a television show pays for the production of the sitcoms. Even a bus shelter is a return, because you've got ads in the bus shelter, but it's keeping you out of the rain. Movie ads gave you nothing. The price of tickets didn't come down.
Yeah.
They broke the unwritten contract. That's why people were so angry at that.
I was furious. You know, not only are you not giving me something, but you're taking something. And you're not taking just a minute. Those ad blocks became 20 minutes
long.
I know. Nothing in return. And that was how I, as a struggling student at the time, justified sneaking into the movies. I was like, all right.
Okay, you can play that game. I'll play this game.
We're going to even the scales. But we used to have these debates about a million things, you know. Like, and it was egregious the first time you would hear the singer-songwriter who you love, Bob Dylan song on an ad, or an ad in a video game was a really big deal.
Yeah.
Or when sponsored content first became a thing. Are you kidding me? This article is a paid article?
Right.
It was scandalous. And bit by bit, we've eroded that outrage to the point where it would be hard to explain to a kid why we were even upset about that, because they accept that we are in a completely commercialized world. Where,
right.
What do you mean? A band is trying to make money.
Right.
I don't want to get all CBC moralizing on you in the way that I was moralized when I wanted to look at marketing on a documentary. But after 18 years of really removing any kind of like judgment right or wrong and just trying to understand advertising and marketing, do you, Terry O'Reilly, look around the world as it has become increasingly brand-focused, corporatized, commercialized, and say, enough with the goddamn ads already?
I do. I do feel that way. I feel that way. Even when I watch a hockey game, if I could wiggle my nose, I take all the ads off the boards. I take all the ads off the ice, leave the playing surface clean. There's a lot of instances where I think it's just gone too far and too much. And advertising becomes its own worst enemy. Even the algorithms I have always railed against, which makes me sound rather like an old ad guy. But I never like the ad algorithms, because it's kind of like a submarine chasing you. Like, you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know that it's charting all of your online buying activity, or if you know you're looking at car dealership ads and you're looking for a car, and then when you go to financing, and then all of a sudden you'll get all these offers from Ford because they've been waiting for that moment to send you that algorithm. I think that is terrible for advertising. And you're sort of seeing it now. Apple has privacy things kicking in now, and they're not going to allow a lot of tracking. And I think that was inevitable because it was terrible. It was a terrible idea. I understand why marketers loved it, why advertisers loved it, because they're getting all this free information and being able to track people in the buying process.